What's the Cape Drive time? 0829 913 913 is the WhatsApp number. Feel free to comment, query, and criticize. As the U.S. inaugurates Joe Biden as its 46th president tomorrow, historians and commentators face an interesting task assessing Donald Trump's 4 years in the Oval Office. Many would agree that it was the final year of his rather interesting presidency that really cemented Trump's legacy, mainly his failure to respond to the COVID pandemic, his second impeachment trial, his lackluster response to Black Lives Matter, and his challenging of the 2020 election results, and of course, the absolutely bizarre January the 6th insurrection at the Capitol building. Tragically for Trump, he can no longer tweet. Can you hear the silence? We now chat to Khalid Beydoun, Professor of Law at Wayne University in the United States. Professor Beydoun, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
When we stand here and we look at the inauguration of Joe Biden and the life and times of Trump, first off, it is interesting that a president of a country, of the United States, can't tweet anymore. And as I said, I'm sure we can all hear the silence.
Yeah, so, you know, as you may know, if you follow U.S. politics really closely, one of the ways in which Donald Trump built his political following was through social media and specifically through Twitter. But Twitter was also the platform where Trump, in especially the last couple of months, was inciting real violence and was inciting real political turbulence that climaxed at the Capitol on January 6th. So Twitter decided that it was high time to remove him as a remedy to end the violence.
And since then, he has been silent, which has been quite strange, hasn't it? Because we've become accustomed to a daily menu of Trump tweets.
He has been silent leading up to the inauguration, which demonstrates that his principal sort of platform for being vocal was Twitter. He's not holding any press conferences. He's not speaking on other social mediums, but he's also been banned on other social mediums. So big tech has really descended on Trump to silence him in these last final days.
It is going to be an interesting chapter in history, isn't it? I'm sure there's a lot of people in the United States who are going to be really scratching their heads when they look at the history books and they read through the 4 years of Trump.
I think so. I mean, you know, Trump has been an aberration. He's been sort of a deviant sort of example of what an American presidency looks like, at least in terms of rhetoric and at least in terms of appearance. One thing that I've been thinking about in writing is, even though it's the end of the Trump administration, it's definitely not the end of Trumpism, right? This ideology, this movement, which champions the ideas, which champions the bigotry of Donald Trump. I think that's going to continue past Biden's inauguration tomorrow.
There are some people who are suggesting that due to the demographics of the United States, and they are fast-changing demographics, where Spanish is probably right now the second language in the United States, and we see the so-called minority groups increasing their numbers. I mean, even amount of Muslims in the United States is increasing exponentially. Do you think that Trumpism represents the nasty, very nasty, last hurrah of white supremacy?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, like you said, the United States is experiencing, you know, people have called it the brownification of America. The fact that the Muslim population is increasing, the Spanish-speaking population is increasing, so on and so forth. And I do. I think what we see with the rise of Trumpism representing, Trump appealing to white anxiety, Trump, you know, to the fact that we have a growing immigrant population, Trump appealing to white supremacy, obviously in very clear ways. But I'm not sure. I'm not convinced that this is the last hurrah of white supremacy. Even though numbers are changing, you know, the white population, and specifically white men, are still vastly overrepresented in politics, business. The vast majority of this country, the United States' wealth, is held by a small percentage of white families. So even though demographics are changing, other metrics of power and influence remain the same. So I think we're going to see white supremacy in these politics of appealing to white anxiety being a staple in American politics for the decades to come. I don't see this as the final hurrah by any means.
White anxiety, and we know something of this from our experiences in South Africa, can be an extremely dangerous thing for any society. Are we justified in sometimes fearing the worst of what's going to come?
Oh, undeniably. And I think that question, especially when you pit it to somebody like me, who is a Muslim living in the United States, in many respects, we have experienced the worst to come, not only with Trump, but during the post 9/11 era, with the policies, with the hate violence that the community has experienced for decades now. So whether it's the black population in the United States, obviously many analogies to South Africa, whether it's the Spanish-speaking population, immigrants, Muslims in the States, we're not only fearing the worst to come, we're getting ready for the worst to come.
Right.
Because we've experienced, the consequence of this rising tide, this rising rage of white anxiety in the years past. And I think it's going to look different, it's going to sound different, and it's going to be inspired by this rhetoric that Trump is going to leave behind even after he leaves office.
One hugely disquieting thing about this scenario that we're discussing is the pathological violence that is expressed. The other day I was looking at some horrendous imagery of these people attacking journalists in a really, really nasty way. There is little room for optimism, is there, when it comes to this particular sort of thing that's playing out?
Yeah, so that was obviously one of the signatures of the Trump administration was to blame the media. His statement was, it's all fake news. And that was essentially, a summons to his following to attack journalists, right? And it was not uncommon for Trump to throw out very respected journalists and to sort of close out very respected newspapers from his press conferences. So his followers began to emulate that. They began to attack individual journalists on the ground, at riots, at protests, at gatherings. In many ways, I think that that is also a reflection of the very polarized popular and political discourse we have in the United States now, especially on the right, but to be frank with you, also on the left, where journalism essentially is becoming, a sounding board for different political factions. And we're experiencing here in the United States, a very frightening decline in objective journalism. And that makes way. That sort of facilitates the process of politicians like Trump being able to blame and scapegoat different news outlets. So for me, it's not surprising when we get to the point of presidents and politicians calling journalists, fake news outlets. The next natural step is to have individuals on the ground actually, identify, isolate, and attack journalists. I think that's a very common sort of progression.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the, as a journalist, one of the more disturbing things I've seen in the last 4 years, and you've already pointed it out, is that the harder Trump's people pushed, I'm not going to call them the right wing, but I'll just use the word Trump, the harder they pushed, there was a push from the other side of the journalistic spectrum, as it were. And the more they pushed, the more Trump pushed, which created a hugely polarizing scenario in United States media, which even before Trump had a lot of questions to answer about itself.
Oh, I definitely agree. And I think that's a very astute observation. Here in the United States, we're sort of bound by a media enterprise that is corporate in nature. our biggest news outlets are backed by huge conglomerates, huge corporations. So they have direct incentive to editorialize in ways that sort of deviate away from objective journalism. And they have incentive to do that, right? So if you watch a Fox News, their incentive is to be as, is to bloviate as much as possible about the evils of the Democrats, because that brings eyes, it brings viewers, and it brings more money. So MSNBC, in many respects, has followed that model. CNN has followed that model. And these three news outlets, I would say, comprise maybe 75 to 80% of the news viewing audience here in the United States. So when you have a news mechanism, an enterprise that is based on financial incentive, that creates a sort of political vacuums and silos that lead to these culture wars that we have in the United States right now.
Some people are suggesting to me that there's a very real proposition that there could even be something akin to a civil war in the United States. I mean, is it as bad as that, or is that just blown up language?
Yeah, I think it's hard to gauge, right? And I'm somebody who knows American history pretty well. I teach the law. When we think civil war, we think about sort of arcane images of old wars pitting factions with muskets and guns fighting against one another.
Right.
So I don't know if that's going to happen, because the country is not sort of a neat binary. It's not South against North. It's not necessarily Black against White. It's not a sort of political dichotomy that would enable a civil war in that regard. But what I do think is the case is that we're experiencing really turbulent and dangerous culture wars, right? Which can, in some respects, lead to armed violence. It's already led to armed violence in many regards. In many respects, can lead to the real racial and political factionalization we see happening at the very earliest stages now, which can lead to political parties being so extreme in their rhetoric and extreme in their policy that they're only serving very small, powerful constituencies, where we can see large segments of the U.S. population having no outlet to address and showcase their grievances against the state unless they're holding these mass protests. So that kind of thing's already happening, and to be frank with you, I see that continuing to happen for the foreseeable future. What that does, though, I think, is it makes the United States more vulnerable in many ways to foreign attack, to the rise of China, to perhaps secession of some states down the line, like, you know, California, Texas, which are very sort of culturally and politically distinct. So maybe not full-fledged civil war, but I would say isolated incidents of violence, of instability, are going to sort of mark the American experience for the next decades to come.
Then there is the scenario, and one watches this with bemusement sometimes, the polarization of United States politics at the center, the Republicans and the Democrats unable to agree on major issues at all. During when Obama tried to put Obamacare, the Republicans stopped it. In fact, the Republicans stopped anything with the name of Obama on it, just because it had the name Obama on it. Okay, Joe Biden might have a slightly better chance, but it's been quite interesting to see the polarity between Republicans and Democrats. Is there any chance, is there any prospect of United States politics reinventing itself out of the fold of Democrats and Republicans?
Not in the near future. I mean, the sad reality is that the United States is characterized by a two-party system, and these two parties have a stranglehold on the structure of the political system. I'm somebody who argues for a need for greater political pluralism. We need more parties. We need more, sort of more political ideological movements that represent different philosophies, that represent different constituencies. much like other democracies that we see having arranged, not even only democracies, but other nations that have a whole host of political parties. I'm guessing South Africa has a greater milieu of political parties than the United States does. Places like Canada does, the UK, so on and so forth. That needs to happen in the United States because in many respects, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party function like oligopolies. They function like political mafias that sort of set the terms, and they benefit off of one another. And unless things change, we're going to see the same sort of political tug of war in Washington that not only maintains the status quo, but also opens the doors for the sort of culture wars and violence that we have happening in the United States. I mean, look, I think it's fair to say that the Trump administration was the primary catalyst of what we see happening in the United States right now. But so was the Democratic Party in many ways, right? Pushing policy and furthering policy that has exacerbated the conditions of poor people, pushing policy that has been very warmongering abroad, pushing policy that has led to, the bombing of Muslim countries, the droning of Muslim countries. So in many respects, what we have is a Trump problem, but it's far greater than that. I think it's systemic, and I think it's rooted in our two-party system. The Democrats, however, on the other end, are more clever with the kind of rhetoric that makes them look less ominous, whereas Trump, his rhetoric makes him look fully ominous and menacing.
No, absolutely. And when we look forward to the Biden-Harris time at the White House, do you think there is a team of leaders there who can make a difference? Kamala Harris interests me. I don't know too much about her policies, but to me, it looks like if Joe Biden does all right, Kamala Harris could have a very good chance of becoming the next president of the United States.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's issue specific, right? So I'm optimistic about the Biden administration on a number of very pressing matters. One of them is COVID. Trump has done a horrendous job on the COVID front, which has led to, I'm not sure what the number was last, but an insane number of Americans dying, and a lot of that was preventable. Trump obviously underestimated, COVID and its eventual impact. I think the Biden administration is going to do a far more effective, far more serious administrative job in addressing COVID in distributing the vaccines. So that's where I'm optimistic. Second, the rhetoric coming from Biden and from the Harris administration is going to be very conciliatory. It's going to embrace multiculturalism. It's going to, at least in terms of pronouncement, embrace minorities in this country. So what that's going to do, hopefully, is suppress the kind of violence we see incited from the White House under the Trump administration. It's not going to embolden the same degree of white anxiety and white supremacy that Trump openly did. Trump was definitely the white supremacist in chief from the sense of, inciting and authorizing that violence. So I'm hopeful on those fronts. And like you said, I think that if the Biden administration does an effective job domestically in stabilizing the political and especially the economic landscape, then that could definitely set up for Kamala Harris succeeding him and becoming not only the first female president, but, the second black president and the first South Asian president. So there's high stakes and a lot of incentive for Kamala Harris to do an effective job as soon as she comes in.
Professor Khalid Baydoun, a U.S. law professor, talking to us about the times of Trump and the potential times of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Both of them are inaugurated tomorrow as Trump leaves center stage. Professor Khalid Baydoun, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I look forward to the next time.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.